in. So let's begin. There might be a few more people coming in. Well, good afternoon. My name is Judy Hall, and I'm on the board of the Young Association of Western Mass, which is hopefully the lecture workshop that you came to see today. Such a rainy, kind of darker, inner, for me, an inner day rather than an outside, active day. So how perfect to be here today to be feeding our souls, feeding the inner world. And that's what we do, the Young Association. We do this usually every month on the first Friday of the month in this room. And we are an organization that is an association of volunteers and that includes all of you. So people who come are part of the association. We are, on our website it says, we are a volunteer-run association open to all persons interested in the life, work, and ideas of Carl Jung and those who have come after him. So the officers I'd like to introduce to you of the board that are here today. Most everybody's here today, actually. So Carol, okay, what's your official title? Outreach Coordinator and Treasurer. And then Christine Olson. Then next to her is Erica, who you'll be hearing from today, Erica Lorenz, and she's our president. And Dan Grunwald, I added a little title for you, Webmaster and Media Coordinator. I'm the secretary. And Penny is not here today. She's a Jungian analyst. She's on our board. Peter. Oh, right next to Dan. There you are. Peter Williams. And he's our archivist. Speaking of which, we have a website, and the address is westmassjung.org, and on it are many of the archives of the lectures, some of them in audio format, and we're starting this, thanks to Christine, we're starting this videotaping, so those will be brought up, uploaded onto our website, so westmassjung.org. And also on the website you can sign in to receive emails about, or an email announcement about our lecture, the upcoming lectures. That's all you get, right, Dan? Just one announcement, maybe two.
Sure.
There's a earlier one and then a reminder of the next lectures. And speaking of which, the next one is going to be given by Anita Green. There's a little flyer for it over here on February 5th, so that is the first Friday of February at 7 right here. It's called The Embodied Unconscious. That's Anita's specialty, love, and passion, the body in relationship to the unconscious as in the body is an expression of the unconscious. We are, as I said, we're a volunteer organization. We rely on donations, so please, as you can, make a donation at the door. Thank you for those who have, and whatever. We suggest $10, but if you can do anything, that's great. We, the Jungian analysts that are local do these lectures gratis, and they, but we bring in speakers from the West Coast, Boston, and we pay for their travel, some of their travel expenses and stipend. And it also helps us with our publicity. We're going to take a short break today. It's longer. Usually the lectures are just 2 hours, 7 to 9. Today's is longer, more leisurely. We're going to take a break at some point. It's more relaxed. But we won't take official bathroom breaks. Meet your own needs. And those, that bathroom's right there, it says men on it, but it's unisex. And what else? There's also I want to say Thayer is also on our board. Thayer Green is Anita's husband, and he's not here, but he's our sort of emeritus analyst and advisor. And take some flyers if you think you can put them around. And Erica, I was going to ask you, is this a something people should pick up? That yeah. So there's a sheet here. Maybe we could pass these around of song lyrics. So if you didn't get one, that looks like a part of the course of the lecture. And these brochures, take these, pass them, post them. And if you want to, you could go here and put your email down. It's easier for us if you just post it on the website, but feel free to go right there. So Erica's brought all these fabulous books, and you can look at them at the break, but these are hers, so feel free to look at them. I was just looking at a couple of them that are just evocative. But they're hers, so please read them. What else? Yes.
At the last meeting, we started something called a book basket, where we have a stash of books to sell now for very low prices. It's not here today because we didn't want to confuse it with Eric's own personal books. So look for the book basket next time, and we'll have books available for sale.
And lastly, one more thing is we often, usually after the lectures, and then today also, we have a salon, which is at the Masonic Restaurant on Mason Street.
Mosaic
Cafe on Masonic Street. I'm not from North Street. Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street, and it's it'll start maybe around 4:30, and it's a time to have some nice good food and meet around a table and talk further about what you've been inspired to, you know, what's been stirred up today.
Do you know what's on the list?
Yes. Okay. Any other questions? And feel free to speak to any of the board members at the break. That's why we're here and why we introduce each other. If you have suggestions, or especially suggestions for how to publicize what we do, or if you want to assist us. So I'm going to introduce Erica when she wants that. So today's workshop is being given by Erica, and Erica is local, a union analyst in local and private practice here. She's been doing this work since the 80s, and she's lectured also and taught workshops all across the U.S. and Canada. And she's also on the Jung Institute of Boston on the training board. Erica has become a friend of mine since I started working for the board and helping. And I enjoy our friendship, and I also enjoy her the way she brings each of the board members little gifts that are kind of whimsical. There's a whimsical feel to Erica, and I appreciate that about her. So, Erica, thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
Am I on? Is it right? Is the sound right? Everybody
yeah.
Can hear me in the back? Okay. Thank you.
Hi.
Welcome, welcome. It's a good time to talk about alchemy in this inner time, as Judy said, and we're having a solucio outside, which is an alchemical operation, which I'll get to. And I've taught this in a course. I've taught it in 2 5-hour workshops. So 3 hours is nothing to try to begin to grasp alchemy. You spend 40, 50, 60 years, a lifetime. And I have some books. One of the things that you have to be comfortable with if you really want to understand alchemy, and even if you really want to understand Jung, is paradox. What he tried to bring back to psychology is paradox, and is the idea of change and transformation that's continuous all our lives. And what I'll be talking about today, there are many deaths and births that we go through, some big, some small, but it never ends. So that's very important for us to understand in the modern times when we think we should know everything. So I will try to make this as brief as I can in 3 hours. We will be taking a break at some appropriate time. And I also want to have a dialogue with you guys, because I don't want to just stand up here and talk at you. That's no fun for me. And also I want to understand what you're understanding and what you want to know. What was that? Please turn off your cell phones.
I'm starting my computer so I can take notes.
Okay, cool. Alchemy goes way back, of course, and the Western alchemy is based on ritual, as many alchemies are, based on ritual, the active relationship to the unconscious, as Jung called it, active imagination, and the symbolic world. So we'll get into that a little bit. One of Jung's major helpers and researchers in alchemy was his colleague, his student, and then colleague, Marie-Louise von Franz, who has two of the easier books to read. Has anybody read Alchemy? It's quite interesting to try to read, isn't it? So von Franz, actually, her books tend to be a little bit more understandable. She's very, and they're most of them are lectures that have been recorded, so she's a little bit more understandable. This is a book that I just found out about and just started reading. It's really fun. It's Robert Bosnak, who's an analyst in California, who studied alchemy for 40 years. It's a novel, and it's based on historical times and a historical alchemist, or an actual alchemist. So you get a real flavor of alchemy in a novel. It's really fun. So at the end of the Red Book, Jung said in the epilogue in 1930, Jung had worked on the Red Book since 1912. He had gone through his experiences after his break with Freud. He had then recorded all of his experiences and painted further paintings in what's called the Red Book. Has people seen the Red Book? A few people? I didn't bring it because it's rather large. But at the very end, towards the end of the Red Book, Richard Wilhelm, who did the I Ching, also translated the Treatise of the Golden Flower, The Secret of the Golden Flower, which is an ancient Chinese alchemical text. And in that, Jung realized that alchemy really was the symbolic system that explained what was going on with him the best. He had looked at Gnosticism, religions from all over the world, and what he discovered was alchemy really helped him to put things together for himself after he continued to work on his experiences in the Red Book. And so he says, with alchemy, it took me away from the Red Book, doing it. My acquaintance with alchemy took me away from the Red Book. There, in alchemy, the contents of this book found their way into actuality, and I could no longer continue working on it. To the superficial observer, it will appear like madness. It would have also developed into one had I not been able to absorb the overpowering force of the original experiences. With the help of alchemy, I could finally arrange them into a whole. I always knew that these experiences contained something precious. So that was the beginning of his study of alchemy in 1928-1930. And actually, Jung had a number of dreams and experiences, specifically alchemical dreams and experiences before that. The first one was he had a fantasy when he was a boy in gymnasium, and he had this fantasy that he was there was a castle, and in the castle was a watchtower, and there was a copper tube that went from the basement all the way up and fanned out on both ends. And in the basement, in the cellar, underneath the central copper conduit, was a laboratory where Jung, this was before he knew anything about alchemy, where Jung made gold. Isn't that amazing? When he was a teenager, I guess, was probably that one. And then his first dream about alchemy was that he was in a library, and in the 16th and 17th century, where there were books embellished with copper and engravings and illustrations of alchemical symbols. Again, he knew nothing about alchemy. And then in 1926, he had a dream. This is from Memory Springs Reflections. How many people have read Memory Springs Reflections? So you might recognize some of these. So he said, and this was a crucial dream, he said. He was with a peasant in a horse-drawn wagon. It was at the end of the war on the front lines. And it was very dangerous. They crossed a bridge, they went through a tunnel, and they saw Verona, Italy, a city of radiant sunlight. Through a lovely springtime countryside, there was a manor house. He goes into the courtyard of the manor house, and suddenly both gates fly shut, and he's stuck in the courtyard of the manor house. The peasant leapt down from his seat and exclaimed, "Now we are caught in the 17th century," which is just that century where alchemy was sort of shifting into science and natural philosophy. Resignedly, I thought, well, that's that. But what is there to do about it? Now we shall be caught for years. Then the consoling thought came to me, someday, years from now, I shall get out again. I don't know if we ever get out again, but that's a consoling thought. And then in 1912, actually, he had a very important dream. This was right after his break with Freud. So this was after his break with Freud. He was in a magnificent Italian villa. In front of me was a table of rare beauty. It was made of emerald green stone. The emerald tablet, the emerald green stone. My children were sitting at the table too. Suddenly a white bird descended and rested on the table. The dove transformed into a little girl, about 8 years of old, with blonde hair. She ran off with the children and played. The little girl returned and tenderly placed her arms around my neck. She suddenly vanished. The dove was back and spoke slowly in a human voice. This is very archaic language from the unconscious. Only in the first hours of the night can I transform myself into a human being while the male dove is busy with the 12 dead. Then she flew off in blue air and I awoke. And he did not understand this dream until he got the alchemical text and he began to understand the symbolism of it. In 1939, Jung had a vision. After he had been working with this material for a while, he woke up and he saw at the foot of his bed Christ on the cross floating. Christ had a greenish gold color. He was the living quality in everything. This greenish gold color is a very alchemical color. It's the living essence of everything. It's life and spirit, the anima mundi, the feminine of the world, the filius macrocosmi. The son of the macrocosm. So that was his vision in 1939. He had many visions. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the history. And please feel free to put up your hand and say, please repeat that, or what are you talking about? And I might not be able to answer your question, but that's all right. So the roots of alchemy, of course, are in shamanism, early metallurgy, embalming in Egypt, all those very, very early arts that combine ritual and the mystery and the body and the earth. Sumeria was the first roots of alchemy were in 3500 BC, in Egypt 3000 BC, in China and Britain 2000 BC, in Greece there began the secret guilds of the metallurgists and alchemists. In Taoism in the 4th century, the alchemist was making a spiritual quest. It was a meditation that allowed the adept to return to the primordial state of chaos, the mother, the earth mother, the womb, to discover the secret of creation, to discover regeneration. In the 9th century, China, it was also considered to be a very esoteric art, using the souls of substances to create transformation. For the Shiite Muslims, which is where the Sufi order came through, the Shiite and the Sunni, Shiite Muslims believe in the symbolic interpretation of the Quran a direct experience of the divine, of God. And there's a very famous Shiite Muslim named Ibn Arabi. Has anybody heard of Ibn Arabi? Yeah. He coined the phrase the mundus imaginalis, which is the intermediate realm of imagination, energy, emotion, where we connect with the divine. In The Birth of Western Alchemy, von Franz says, was the interest, there was, you've got to realize this was when the Catholic Church was very strong and getting more and more patriarchal. So there was a backlash, there was a resurgence of interest in matter, a resurgence of interest in the mother archetype that counterbalanced the Catholic Church. And in Europe in the 7th to 12th century, alchemy came through the Middle East and Northern Africa into Spain, where there was amazing amalgamation of the Jewish, the Islam, and Christian study and art and medicine and mysticism, and also in southern Italy, where last year I talked about the Dionysian women's mystery in southern Italy. So alchemy continued with the Freemasons, the Rosicrucians, the Kabbalists, and the Knights of Templar all the way up till 19... There was a Samuel Hahnemann who started homeopathy in 1796. He was the one who sort of found the thread again. And 1796? Yes. And he discovered like cures like, and he began to work on remedies, which are now homeopathy. So some of the, in the early 14th and 15th century, the world was thought to be entirely animated. Matter is living soul. The relationship between all levels of existence, it's not causal. The lumen naturae is the light of nature. The lumen naturae. Very important. The Emerald Tablet is the oldest document in 800 AD. It has Phoenician characters, and that's the table that Jung dreamed about. Some of the most famous alchemists that we might recognize are Roger Bacon, who was a Franciscan priest, Albert Magnus, Albert the Great in the 13th century, who was the teacher of Thomas Aquinas, Paracelsus, who was one of the most famous in 1493, lived till 1541, who taught in Basel, Switzerland, and Newton was an alchemist. The purpose of alchemy, von Franz says, is to make the arcana, the secret remedies, for all these things conform to the instruction and test of nature. Hence, nature and human, in health and sickness, need to be joined together. To be brought into mutual agreement, compassion is the physician's schoolmate. Actually, that's a quote from Paracelsus. So as religion codified the connection to God, alchemy kept the connection to between the earth, between us and God open. And the Catholic Church began to say only God has spirit, only humans have soul, and the sacred marriage, the hierosgamos, was lost. And was particularly kept, let me make one more. This particularly kept happening in Descartes' time, 1596 to 1650, as we all know, was sort of the birth of modern science, and and truth was directly experienced through the senses. So, yes?
I know you quoted the purpose of alchemy. Could you translate that into layman's terms?
We will. Don't worry. This is just the beginning. Well, I'll try, shall we say. Okay. So here we have a picture, a sort of a basic picture of alchemy. here we have the astrological signs and planets, which are part of the energy that works through the metals. These are all the metals. The seven metals, Venus, the sun, gold, silver, copper, all of them. Here we have the four elements. I'll get to this. Here we have Mercurius. Mercurius is the god, the catalyst, the god of alchemy, the Mercurius or Hermes in the Roman Mercurius is the one who changes, the one who comes in and flits and fleets and grabs us and throws us down and tricks us into change. In Faust, it was Mercurius who came in as the devil, and with as the black poodle and the devil, and started Faust on his journey. So it's the autonomous spirit of the archetypal psyche, spiritual and physical, masculine and feminine. He mediates between the body and the spirit. He's a paradoxical manifestation of the big S self. Shall I define a few of these terms, like self, what Jung meant by self?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. So self is our particular experience. I have my own particular connection to the divine. So I have a connection to the self, which everybody has. It's an archetype, meaning it is ubiquitous. All of our species have these patterns, these instinctual archetypal patterns, images, that the instinctual and imaginal powers and experiences. And the self is my particular connection, or your particular connection, your particular manifestation or circle of archetypes that the divine is trying to work with you in this lifetime. So Mercurius might come in with a particular message for you from the self. Mercurius unites above and below. Power is the power of sexuality. And Dionysian is sort of a mercurial god, too. He's very feminine and masculine. He's very trickster-esque. He has to do with wine and ecstasy and death and the feminine. The union of the opposites. He is elusive, deceptive, ever-changing content that possesses us like a daemon and flits from the person to the analyst or the person to another person, the projections we have, the psychological connections that we have, sometimes teasing. He's a wily god of revelation. So he's the god of revelation. He's inexhaustible, inventive, intriguing, ambivalent, connective agent. He has a winged hat, and winged slippers, and sandals, and he carries the caduceus, which of course was started with Asclepius and became that of the winged serpents of medicine. The alchemists were mostly the most highly learned people of their times. They were the doctors. They were looking for the elixir, the medicine that could cure all. They were the medicine. They were supported by of course everybody wanted them to change stuff into gold. But that really wasn't the true journey of the alchemist. The true journey of the alchemist was a spiritual journey to discover the philosopher's stone, which is the true gold, their own truth, their true connection to their divine. So Mercurius is a magician. He's the god of travelers and guides. He conducts the souls of the dead to the underworld. He's a god of commerce, of chance, of wind, of flint. He's a medium of the conjunctio. He's a medium of the sacred marriage. He's the sulfur. He's the fountain. These are some images of Mercurius. And then we have, all of the planets are very important, but the certain ones, the sun, of course, is the masculine. The moon is the feminine. The moon is very important in alchemy. It's the dew, the agent of healing grace. We'll see a slide later. The water of the divine wisdom, the aqua permanens, the permanent waters, the gateway between the celestial and earthly realms. And this is the most important thing, is that's what they were looking for. They were looking to reconnect with matter, with the spirit and matter, with the feminine. So the moon is a way for the spiritual to become embodied, to solidify life's energies into concrete experience. Sulfur was also very important. It was a metal that does not burn. It's a metal that does not burn. It's hot, daemonic, the principle of life, psychic healing. And lead is also very important. Lead is the prima materia. Okay. So let's see. So here we have the blind who's looking for, that's what we all are, we're all blind, we're looking for the connection, we're looking for the little instinctual animals that go into the earth and come out with their helper. And here is the alchemical laboratory with the sun and the moon above and the rising phoenix. So here is the inner sanctum underneath the mountain where the treasure is found, and behind is the ocean of death, the collective unconscious, the deepest levels of the unconscious. Here are a few Jung quotes. Alchemy points back to the primordial matriarchal world, which was overthrown by the masculine world of the father. The alchemists believed any substance has its own nature, energy grade, or pattern on a concrete material plane and on the emotional, mental, and spiritual planes. While alchemists maneuvered physical properties, he was also interacting with other dimensions. Jung speculated that probably the unconscious has a material aspect, which would be why it knows about matter, why the unconscious knows about matter. It's interesting. If this were so, then there would be a dim or vague phenomena of consciousness even in inorganic matter. So that was quite a thought for the time. Shall I read that one again?
That makes a lot of sense.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Jung speculated that probably the unconscious has a material aspect, which would be why it knows about matter. If this were so, then there would be a dim or vague phenomena of consciousness, even in the inorganic world. That's what the alchemists believed. The adepts strove to realize their speculative ideas in the form of the chemical substance, which they thought was endowed with magical power. So they were projecting whatever was coming up from their unconscious onto the substance that they were working with. Jung says, projections of the alchemists were nothing other than unconscious contents appearing in matter, the same contents that modern psychotherapy makes conscious by the method of active imagination. Before the unconscious changes that unconscious material coming up and projects it out onto the world, to a person, to a race, to a war, to a country, to power, whatever we project it on. The alchemists knew from centuries of experience that through imitation, initiation rites, and rituals, we could be transformed, die, and be reborn. We would see the world differently. That's what we're looking for. The world isn't going to change, but our perspective can change. Our relationship to whatever we're working with can change. Imagination is a guide to the truth. Jung says the alchemists were so steeped in their inner experiences, their sole concern was to devise fitting images and expressions regardless of whether they were intelligible or not. Although in this respect they remained behind the times, they nevertheless performed the inestimable service of having constructed a phenomenology of the unconscious before the advent of psychology. Shall I read that one again? That's a good one. The alchemists were so steeped in their inner experiences that their sole concern was to devise fitting images and expressions regardless of whether these were intelligible or not, which they are not very intelligible. Although in this respect they remained behind the times, they nevertheless formed the inestimable service of having constructed a phenomenology of the unconscious long before the advent of psychology. Okay. Next. Jung said, we should not begrudge the alchemists their secret language, which, by the way, I think was also partly due to what they were doing, but also the Inquisition. They did not want to be caught by the Inquisition. And they tried to explain what they were talking about in a very symbolic language that could only be understood by somebody who wanted to know the true art.
So the sort of thing where if you were initiated, you knew what the codes were.
Well, there weren't exactly codes, but you knew the language. You had been initiated sort of into the language and the ideas.
and the experiences, which is the most important piece.
Yeah. So, we should not begrudge the alchemist their secret language. Deeper sight into the problems of psychic development soon teaches us how much it is, how much better it is to reserve judgment instead of prematurely, I'm sorry, I'm stumbling all over the place here. I must be in Seleucio, I'm not quite here. To reserve judgment instead of prematurely announcing to all and sundry what's what. Of course, we all have a desire for crystal clarity, which in the modern age certainly does, but we are apt to forget that in psychic matters we are dealing with processes of experiences, that is, with transformations which should never be given hard and fast names if their living movement is not to petrify into something static. For the symbol not only conveys a visualization of the process, but it also brings a re-experiencing of it, which to much clarity only dispels. So that's very important. One of my experiences of alchemy when I was first developing this to teach in a 5-hour workshop was I had come to the place where I needed to pick my alchemical pictures. And I was sitting on my bedroom floor surrounded by alchemical books with pictures all over the place. And I was sitting there and I was totally overwhelmed. It's like, huh? Not only had I been reading and studying alchemy for a number of months, but I had just gotten to this place where I was saturated and I couldn't take anything else in. So I was in a state of solutio, of overwhelm. So I closed my eyes and I just sat there still for a while. And then the thought came to me, just pick the ones you like. So I opened my eyes and I just picked my favorites. And then, lo and behold, they seem to make they seem to be progressive. So that's how I chose these pictures. And as I was working on the pictures again, yesterday I think it was, I had a hot cup of hot tea on the table, and suddenly I knocked it over. The hot water went everywhere on one of my favorite tables on the floor into the Wi-Fi system. And I scrambled to clean it all up, and I thought, well, here it is again, Seleucio. So.
And Mercury going into retrograde.
Mercury just went into retrograde. Oh, it feels like it's been there for months. When is it coming out?
Give it a month.
Yeah. Okay. So, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to follow find nature. This is the pregnant world, of course, the suckling of nature. In the back, cities are considered symbols of consciousness. And then we have the sea beyond, the sea which, of course, is the goes deep, deep, deep into the collective unconscious. So here we have Mother Nature. So actually, this is sort of a symbol too, right here, of one of the processes or the experiences of alchemy, which is coagulatio, when things gel, when they come together, when you take the water out of something, if you're overwhelmed, and suddenly it becomes clear. So here we have this rotund, earthy, coagulated state of Mother Nature. Feel free to ask questions. So what do we have here? We have the city, consciousness, and here we have the blind man, person, with the light of consciousness, blind, following nature, following our true nature. That's what we're looking for in life, in meditation, in analysis. We're following nature. This is one of my favorite ones. This is Sophia. And Sophia, she really starts in the Greek. Sophia is wisdom. She's God's earliest creation and playmate. So she in some myths, she creates the world. She is sent and she creates the world. And here she radiates energy, light, fire. She's standing on the moon in the middle of this dark blue
perhaps water. Here we have the iridescent green, it's the living gold, the living life. And she's opening her belly to show us the instinctual deep parts of ourselves in our gut, which is the primary brain, has more neuroreceptors than other parts of the body. So this is our instinctual center down here. She stands, let's see, anything else?
What year is this slack place from?
This is, we put a staple over it.
14th century incision.
14th century.
The one before this one?
Oh, the one before this one? Let's see. That one is 17th century. Yeah. So these are from all over the map. These are wonderful pictures. See what the next one is. Okay. So what are we doing in alchemy? We're looking for the treasure in the ground. Here's a primal gnome-like creature. This is a human being, and we're digging. We're digging, and behind is the ocean. This is a pastoral scene. We have water. These pictures. This is from the Splendor Solis, which was the 1588. This is a wonderful book. It's very, very detailed and dense. It's by Joseph Henderson, who's an analyst, worked with Jung. And it's the Splendor Solis, which is actually the alchemist that this book is about. So this is the alchemist that made these pictures. They're absolutely phenomenal. And everything in this picture means something, which I won't get into. Is that fun yet? Wow. I guess I'm starting. Everything in this picture, everything in this frame means something, which we don't have time to get into, unfortunately. But some important things. So we have the dwarf and the man digging. We have the pastoral scene. We have the moon observing in the water, in the unconscious, observing, watching. Let's see. We're unearthing the origins of what's gone wrong and our instinctual strivings. The goal of the treasure is found in the subtleties of behavior, not just words and images, the nuances of nonverbal communication and experience. To find the buried treasure, we get to deeper meaning. We regress in the service of the self, the biggest self, in the service of the divine. To discover the hidden mysteries and the state of being comes from after intense working through all of our personal material, digging and digging and digging. So we have this bronze moon boat. And this is purely the receptive feminine presence here. And down here we have a very interesting scene, which is the king, I can't pronounce his name. He was an early king. And Queen Esther, which was a Jewish, she was Jewish. He divorced his queen, and he wants to marry Esther. And she says that she will only marry him if he starts a new relationship with the Jews and accepts the Jews. So this is an amazing picture of the patriarchy accepting the feminine that is not the feminine of the aristocratic authority, but the feminine of a simple feminine that's wise, and bestowing on her the honor of granting her wish that all peoples are accepted. Okay, let's see, what else do we have? We see here little Kabiri, little children and Kabiri that are working with these people, and the children with the birds. You see the nature, the birds that come down from the heavens. And so let's see if I'm missing anything. We see the sun, which is shining, the moon, the soul, the sun, that's shining through the rainstorm. All of nature is in play here.
So this is this the these pictures like this are all from the Splendor Solis period, which is 1582. So this is another view of what we're basically doing in alchemy. So we have the tile stove, which would be the alchemical stove. You see a little white cat here. This is all the feminine and children. This is the mother. It's interesting because this sort of goes developmentally from the infant and the toddler. And here we have an older child playing with a younger child. So in alchemy, we're playing. We're playing with the substances. We're playing with the unconscious. We're playing with our psychological and spiritual process. It's in the drive of play and curiosity and exploration. And here we have two children in parallel play. They aren't playing together yet. Maybe some of our different parts of our psyche don't know how to relate to each other at this point. And here we have children that are actually playing together, so they must be 4 years old or so. So, and this is the red and gold of the alchemical colors, the red being the fire, the passion, the gold being the true gold. So, and the sun is coming through, and all of this around here is nature. We're all surrounded by nature. Any questions? Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you. How did you know? Back here, this is the alchemical laboratory. These are the alembics, or the vessels, where the substances were heated and changed. And back here looks like a helper of the alchemist. Alchemists were not just men, they were also women. So one of the most famous was Maria Prophetessa, one of the most famous female alchemists. So what are we working with? We're working with the prima materia. Anybody know that word, the prima materia? We find the prima materia, we don't make it. We find it. It's already here. It's in our unconscious. It's in our complexes, our issues. It's in the world. We project onto our boss. We project onto other people. It's all here. The prima materia is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's psychological material. It's moods, personal reactions, instinctive drives. It's whatever is despised or rejected in us. The shadow, whatever, even good things. The shadow is not bad. The shadow is also the most positive parts of ourselves that we don't accept. It's the most painful, the most humiliating places. It's a long time repeating problem that just keeps coming back and saying, okay, it's time to work on me now. It's all of our fragmented parts. Jung was the first one who said, we aren't just the ego. Freud knew we were the unconscious, but Jung really honored the different parts of the psyche. And the whole point is to get different parts of the psyche to connect and to communicate with each other and to grow and to integrate. It's the undifferentiated, it's the fear of dissolution or the awe of eternity. It's the womb of the mother, the prima materia. As Jung says in the Psychology of the Transference, actually Jung and Freud were the first psychiatrists to say, wow, our reactions and our issues and our counter-transference might have something to do with what's going on in this relationship that we're having. He says that it's the familiarization with one's partner that's brought about through projection. In other words, we always project, and then we get the chance to go, oh, why am I seeing that over there? What do I need to do about it over here? Projection of archaic infantile fantasies that were originally invested in members of our own family. It's the transference of these fantasies that draws us into the atmosphere of the family, into working with the prima materia. The unknown substance that carries projection of autonomous psychic content. Some of the symbols of the prima materia are lead, mud, poison, shit, hidden, heating, urine, salt, earth, blood, sea, dragon, Hades, cloud, fire, water, nature, symbols, the microcosm, the sea, the chaos, the original sea, the vessels of contradiction. So here we see a wonderful image of chaos. So this is, look at all the animals, the sin, it's like a centaur, the conjunctio down here, the ram, the looks like a dog or something, here's whoever the wind god is, all these animals all mixed up in this. The luminatura, the little stars, the light in the darkness. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for the light in the darkness. If you meditate, or if you just close your eyes and you can stay, as Jung says, if you can't stand yourself not doing something, then nobody else can stand you. So we need to learn to sit and be still and be allow the darkness to happen, so that other deeper things can come up, so that we can allow whatever needs to come through to emerge. And that can be very frightening, especially if the darkness has been connected with very painful experiences. Here's another image of the prana materia, or the chaos. This huge dog creature that's eating people and hanging people and clawing people. And this is the person who's selling the gold with the black slippers. And here might be the alchemist working on the fire down here in the corner. And this is probably Mercurius, because he was a god of commerce. And these are all the people who want to connect with this process. So he's selling. Anybody have any thoughts or questions? This is a lot to take in at once.
Well, it's interesting that he's he's a trickster, you said, in nature, but he's also a god of commerce.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty tricky, isn't it?
He's not really selling what he's selling.
Uh-huh. Right, right. You think he's selling one thing, and then wham. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions?
What do you say again about the god?
Well, this would be sort of the mercurial, the prana materia that grabs us, you know, that grabs us by his tail or by his claws or by his mouth and captures us and holds us. So we start to go into the process. Okay. Yeah.
I'm not quite sure if I'm understanding this guy here, the customer on the right with the hat on, is
yeah.
reaching into another person's purse behind him. Or is that his servant carrying his purse? It looks like somebody's hands are in other people's purses.
Ah, that would be tricky, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
We are in other people's purses, aren't we? Constantly. Messing with other people's purses. Projecting, you know, stealing. Yeah, good point. Yeah, they're all sort of connected through the purses, aren't they? Different hands. Yeah. And here the poor alchemist is just sitting over here in the corner doing his thing. Yes?
Is there maybe some sort of relationship between the black boots, the black socks, whatever they are,
uh-huh.
Mercurius is holding, and the creature above,
right.
almost like there's this hidden world of the socks. Where is somebody standing on top of this kind of material or something?
Right.
Or is that a wink and a nudge to Hermes' sandals?
What?
Or is that like a wink and a nudge to Hermes' sandals?
Well, they aren't winged, but if this is Hermes, this is Mercurius, then yeah.
It may also be vehicle of some sort. We go into them and
mm-hmm.
move through the world. And
yeah, and they're black. I'll get to black in a minute. Yeah, they're black for a reason. Yes?
I was going to say that my first thought of the animal, it looks a lot like Cerberus, you know,
mm-hmm.
starting the
gates of the underworld, absolutely, which is where we go. Okay, go ahead.
When you read that list with Suprema Akira, poison is in there.
Uh-huh.
Poison feels like it should be in a different category.
Ah.
All those, how does poison get in there?
Well, the prana materia is anything that is difficult, that is potentially dangerous, that is potentially poison. Poison doesn't just kill, it also can heal in the right drop, right? Like heals like. That's an alchemical and a homeopathic idea, that like heals like. So, Hermes and the prana materia, all these symbols, sulfur, they're all about
the danger and the powerful energies and emotions and complexes that we're working with that can make us go crazy or they can make us transform. Right? Okay. Okay, so let's go on a little bit. So this is the alchemical vessel. I love the image of the alchemical vessel because we need a container to work in. If we don't have a container to work in, whatever that means, then we're going to be in trouble. So the alembic, or the alchemical vessel, it says, this is von Franz, the vessel is a symbol for the attitude which prevents anything from escaping to the outside. So when we're working on ourselves, we want to try to not, we want to try to keep it within our own realm. We want to pull those projections back that we're doing. It is a basic attitude of introversion, which on principle does not let anything escape into the outside world. The illusion that the whole trouble lies outside oneself has to come to an end, and things have to be looked at from the inside, so that we're going to the inner world. So it means to put yourself in an attitude of reflection, in which you ask yourself where your conscious processes come from. Link that with your fantasy material, which is the vapor which comes up from the unconscious, and that creates a living insight, which is bitter. A living insight which is bitter. The insight we obtain by looking at ourselves is generally very bitter. So those times like, oh, me? I didn't know I did that. I didn't know I was just projecting that out there. If it corrodes and is very disagreeable, to the illusions of consciousness. That's why it's bitter. It's like, oh no, I have to face that. I have to stop doing that. Okay. So here we have a beautiful alchemical vessel. This is very interesting because all the work around here is done by the masculine. This is the Pope, which is putting a crown on a king. And it's all very calm and orderly. There's a guy going on a hunt. Oh, here's the hunt. Here's the alchemist working with the vessel with the helper and the dog, the instinctual energy. And this is an alembic, a chemical vessel. It's totally enclosed. It has a darkness in the background. Here's the true gold, the philosopher's stone, the opus. Let me read. So the goal is to reach the opus. And the opus is the concrete practical efficacy of consciousness and wisdom. It's a universal solvent. If we have that wisdom, then we can understand, we can be with whatever is. It's the penetrating water. It's the tincture. It's called the lapis. It's called the philosopher's stone. It's not real gold. It's the true gold. It's the permanens aqua, it's the sapienta dei, the elixir vitae, and it's the divine water. So that's what we're trying to get to. Those are symbols of what we're trying to get to. Okay, let me see this. So,
quick technical question?
Yeah.
Are all of these images you're showing us from one particular alchemical treatise?
No.
So you're
this is the ones that are colored, beautifully colored like this, are from the Splendor Solus, which is Trismosin, the alchemist in the, they were from the 1700s, or 17th century. So here we have three birds, and these birds are very important. One of the reasons I wanted to show this slide is they show three major colors, three major parts of the process, three sort of general parts of the process. One is the negredo, which is black. The other is the albedo, which is white, and the other is the end of the process, which is red. There are some other colors that go along, but we won't get into them. These are sort of the three that you see a lot and are talked about. So, who's on top in this one? The red and the white. The black bird is being taken over or tamed or whatever they're doing in there. And here's the laurel, the wreath of laurel, which is nature. And it's totally enclosed. There's no way to get out, which is what it needs to be. And there's conversation and observation happening over here, which is what we need to do. And it's ruled by Jupiter, who's being
pulled by these peacocks, and we'll get to the peacocks a little bit later. But the god Jupiter is sort of overruling this. So in a way, this is saying when we're really involved in this intense process, we need to be in a place that is safe, as safe as we can be. Sometimes it just overwhelms us, and we're there we are in the middle of it, and we have to deal with it. Life does that. Okay. Let's see if there's anything else. So the negredo, which is usually the first part of the process, is when we really descend. We really go in. We're forced into a depression. Something happens in our life that throws us totally overboard, that overwhelms us. It's our confusion. It's the black cloud of unknowing. It's the bewildering aspect of the Godhead. The closer the soul gets to God, the darker and more confused we get, our consciousness gets. We have to be stripped of every idea, intellectual concept, before we can approach the light. So it dissolves our defenses on a psychic and a body level. I'm sure everybody in here has been through some event in your life that's just blown you open, and your defenses are gone, and you're just sitting there, trying to be safe, trying to come to some understanding. It's the inferior parts of ourselves, the negredo, the black. We experience the negredo over and over. We experience these processes over and over again. It's not like in modern life we keep thinking, well, I'm going to get to the end. I'm going to get to the philosopher's gold and that'll be it, right? No. We never get to the end. Von Franz says, once you get to the end of your complexes, you don't need to be here, you're dead. So it goes on. That the good news is that when people say, well, how long is this going to take? I say, I don't know. But then I say, well, the good news is that you've got your complexes probably when you were a kid or when something happened. You probably won't get any more complexes unless something really, really intense and horrible happens. So you're going to be dealing with the same issues over and over again. So that's the good news, that you don't have to get any more. The bad news is you have to keep excavating them and mining them and looking at them, and they'll keep coming around until they're neutralized, whatever that means. Okay, it's the dark initial state of the chaos like we saw before with the dog. So this is, I think, the black boots are related to the negredo. It's where we step first. The elements are in conflict. They repel one another. They're sort of repelling and fighting and struggling with each other. All the connections are dissolved. The dissolution is a prerequisite for redemption. My favorite movies are those of redemption, where everything falls apart and then the bad guy really finds himself and is redeemed, or the bad person. Okay, just when the negredo is at its worst, the secret birth takes place in the unconscious. That's nice to try to remember when we're there, right? Hard. That's something that our friends, our teachers, our analysts carry, our therapists carry, that just at the darkest moment is when the shift begins to happen. Very important for somebody to carry that. Okay. I'm doing three things at once here, which is very alchemical. Okay. Yep. There's the peacock. Whoops. Let me go to the black one. This is Sam Harlan, a Jungian analyst in Pittsburgh, who's very bright, wrote a whole book on the black sun. So this is the black sun. So this is the negredo process. This is the beginning. So in Dante's Inferno, it's called a journey that gathers light from a descent into the darkness, a pilgrimage of knowledge that penetrating deep seemingly turns away from the light. So we have the sun that's just under the horizon and all the dead stuff happening. There's a dry riverbed down here. The sun is black with gold. A little bit of gold showing through. It is the dawn. It is the turning moment.
But in here, we see that the green leaves have a little bit of gold, the true gold, the philosopher's gold. And here again is nature, all of nature surrounding and participating in and being a part of. And what's the expression on the black sun?
Not this again.
Not this again? There you go. That's a good one. Yeah.
It's looking to the side.
It's looking to the side. Sort of. Yeah, well, one, yeah, it looks worried. That's what we feel when we're in this place. We're worried. Oh my goodness, what am I going to do now? Here's the city of consciousness just in the back, just beginning to get the sun a little bit. And in the dark, dry riverbed down here, we see little plants just beginning to grow. They're there, but they're not conscious yet. They're not fully there. Any other thoughts about his expression? Yeah.
Not necessarily his expression, but it seems like the water that is there is flowing through the back of his mind.
Ah, there you go. The rivers?
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? There's the water which is flowing.
It's like a drowned sun.
It looks like a drowned sun.
Bemused.
A bemused. The trickster part of it, right? Yeah. Let's see if I lost anything. This is the plant symbolism. It talks about the vegetative level of the nervous system, the psychosomatic responses. And Jung says that our neurosis is in our belly. We feel it. Our guts churn. We have indigestion. Things aren't digesting yet. Okay. And this is also the lumina tori. Okay, so we go into this dark. Yes.
I've got a few questions at this point. As far as the sun's expression, like he's in pain.
Mm-hmm.
The cities you mentioned, when you mentioned them earlier, it occurred to me that they looked like relatively insignificant little human fabrications.
Mm-hmm.
And you said they represented consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I take it that does not mean awareness.
It means a certain level of consciousness, perhaps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
Okay. And the negredo, your description of it reminds me a lot of the prima materia. How would you differentiate that?
Well, the prima materia is the material, the initial material that we're working on.
Mm-hmm.
So that is in the negredo. They are, you're right, they're sort of kind of...
So the prima materia
is entering the prima materia?
Yes, the negredo is the process of working with of entering into a relationship with the prima materia, whether we want to or whether we're forced to. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But there's all kinds of stuff in there.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's nothing wrong with urine or poison or or the black earth or snails.
I find that muddy water there interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a few maybe rocks. I don't know if those kind of look like rocks. But your little plants that are happening, beginning. So it's not, so the water is somewhere maybe underground.
Isn't that a mud puddle?
I don't think so. I think this is dry. I think these are rocks. But you're right. The water is down under the earth. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Would there be an association with entering the negredo and shadow work?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because I would think that particularly for somebody in the medieval world,
mm-hmm.
so detached from their own animal nature, to their own primal anything, that that's what's going to come up a bunch when you're doing that.
Well, I think that comes up a bunch when in the modern world, too. Mm-hmm.
Well, certainly.
But I think the medieval mind had this amazing way of holding opposites simultaneously and not being bothered by it. Of course, we have a lot of people like Trump who do that, too. But I think the medieval mind was known for its plasticity. Very interesting. Yeah.
Did you mention that the symbols of nature were associated with the nervous system? Did I hear that?
Yeah.
That
sure. Nature is our instinct, our sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system that tells us something's wrong before we go, oh, there's something wrong.
right? Our heart pounds, we get anxious, our belly churns.
Another interesting thing in this image is that the tree of a cut, but you're not climbing at all. Is this image representative of that descent into?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. Yes. One more question? You have another over there? Oh, okay. Okay. So, wait a minute. Let's see where
I am. I have one more comment on that. The black sun.
Uh-huh.
It kind of looked like it was a reflection, like it's the moon in the water as well as the sun. So that was interesting.
Yeah, the black sun. Yeah, sort of that lunar black sun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The occluded sun, perhaps an ecliptic sun, perhaps. Yeah. Okay. So when we go through the negredo, which is the most difficult part of the process, we're very unconscious. We're just in various alchemical processes in that. And then we get to the albedo, which is a dawning awareness. We're beginning to get insights. It's the turning point. And here is a picture. The peacock is a part of that. See all the little... Her color, her coat, there's so many little moons or little colors in her tail. So she's a real image of color happening. This is ruled by Venus. The albedo is ruled by Venus. The albedo means the whitening. The negredo means the darkening. The albedo is the whitening. So here we have Venus with Eros in front, who's shooting the sun, giving the sun a little bit of Eros, and birds once again. And here we have a pastoral scene that really has a lot more to do with community and working together and relaxing and playing, and the feminine, the masculine, relaxing, and Eros here, and dancing perhaps. So the albedo is is the beginning of a lighter state of one sense of what's going on in oneself. Eros is the communication of discriminated feeling. So in the negredo, we might be just flooded with an emotion, sobbing or anger or whatever. And in the albedo, we're beginning to discern what's helpful, what's not, what's projection, what's we need to integrate and what we don't need to integrate. So this is once again in a gold niche, but it's more, there's an opening at the top. There's the beginning of an opening. Here's the philosopher's crown of the true gold. And this is held down, so it can't rise yet. Okay? And it has these pillars, which again have these symbols, nature up here, and the symbols of people down here. And there's no opposition. Everything's sort of harmonious in a different way than the past slide, which was more of a working, things happening. This is more relaxed. And this symbolizes an openness between the personal unconscious or the ego or our observing self and the unconscious, the depth of the unconscious. The albedo is a turning point. It's truly the dawn of a new day in the psyche, where the outer activity and the inner state are in harmony. Neither is opposing nor compensating. Neither is opposing or compensating. It's a partnership between an open relationship to contents emerging from the unconscious and a more ability to receive those contents and be conscious of them and work with them openly. It's a genuine relating to ourselves. After a long negredo process of inner development and realization, the projection is withdrawn and a sort of peace can establish itself. So it's the beginning of the real process of the redemption of the shadow. Whatever we hate about ourselves, whether it's good or bad, can be good. If we have a beautiful gift and we've been taught to not accept it, that can be part of the shadow. To know it enriches our experience of life. We're ready to affirm a healthier attitude towards whatever. the meditation teachers I work with and the Jungian analysts I work with, they say, just be with it. Be with whatever comes up. Allow yourself to immerse yourself in the feeling, in the instinct, in the emotion. It requires the help of a guardian spirit if the nigredo is very intense, which is a living symbol of the unconscious, which is what Mercury is. He's a living symbol. Okay. So what was formerly painful and problematic, we begin to be able to relate to it even more easily.
All right. Yeah.
In some slides, there's an image of the alchemist somewhere
mm-hmm.
and then another is not.
Mm-hmm.
What would that be about?
Well, I think in these, it's sort of like you're more immersed in the process, so you don't see the alchemist doing the actual procedure, but you're just there in it. Okay. And they're also symbolizing different aspects of the work.
You mentioned that during intense nigredo periods there might be like some kind of helper spirit or psychopompy sort of thing, you're saying,
mm-hmm.
Hermes. So the nigredo does have like kind of an initiatory trial by fire
sort
of thing. Okay,
right,
gotcha.
Right. Or it can be just sort of a sinking into the mud of lethargy and apathy and nothingness, right? But often we get triggered by something. Yeah.
In terms of understanding this in the states of light and darkness and the sun,
uh-huh.
Albedo is kind of that moment after the very darkness of the night when the sun hasn't come up yet.
Right.
It's
where the top of the black
light.
Sun. You know?
Right, that black sun picture was very nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So
it's
things haven't yet appeared, or they're starting to appear.
Right. It is the dawn, but it's just the peaking of the dawn. Right? Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, kind of picking up on that, but going back to two images, to the sun, the sun,
uh-huh.
sun.
That's a good one.
I was really struck by the pink clouds.
Uh-huh.
And then the next panel, the pink panel, and
uh-huh.
the peacock, is uh-huh. the vessel. And now in this one,
mm-hmm.
a deepening
yes.
of pink,
mm-hmm.
you're getting the white and the red mixed.
Mm-hmm.
And the red is starting to come in.
And these pictures are rather gruesome and odd. They're of floggings and whippings, but the female is being protected by the masculine here. So it's the protection. It's the pink is the feminine. It'd be the feminine relatedness. Yeah, here in this one. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Do you know how large this is in the original?
No, I don't. Yeah. It's bigger. It's smaller than on the screen.
It's not a big wall, is it?
No. It's a. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not sure if in this book they're the actual size or not. Yeah. Yes. Dana, go ahead.
I just was wondering that Jupiter as peacock at the top of the first one.
Uh huh.
And then the peacock was inside.
Uh huh. Uh-huh.
So that's also in the center.
Yeah, you have to realize that in alchemy, as in the process, things can shift and change and be in odd places that we don't expect. So if you try to think of this in any kind of linear process, it's not going to quite work. You have to flow with it. I must be into the Seleucio, keep flowing. So, yeah. Uh-huh.
I had a related observation. Of course, the peacock was in the alembic, the
mm-hmm.
peacock was not drawing the chariot, but the birds that were drawing the chariot look like blue jays,
mm-hmm.
which are intelligent,
mm-hmm.
but they're also kind of trickster-like birds
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some
sure.
symbol, is there some acknowledged symbolic meaning of that?
I'm not sure if you said, those are the sort of details that it's hard to get into in this short period of time. I'd have to look back on my notes to see exactly what those particular birds were. But yes, everything in the painting means something. It's really quite phenomenal.
Blue jays are related to crows,
mm-hmm.
and one of the symbolic aspects of that species for me is that they eat dead stuff up and transform
yeah.
it back into.
Yeah, yeah. There you have a beautiful image of Hermes or Mercurius right there. Yeah. Yeah, okay, good. Let's see. So the next phase is the rubedo, which means the reddening. So we have the darkening, the black, the whitening, the albedo, and the red. So that's when a new life that appears spontaneously after the libido is freed from the complex. So it's the embodied self. Suddenly we have the insight. We have the connection. And that's part of what the peacock is. So higher consciousness from nature, and something nature alone cannot create. Something from nature alone. Nature alone cannot create this. It's the relationship between our consciousness and nature, our work with the nature, our connection to nature that brings the libido. Humans recognize themselves as part of nature and try to live in balance with it. Now, what would nature be? Nature would be outside, nature would be inside, our nature, our issues, our complexes. Okay, so let's see. Let's take a little break, and I'm going to go into four of there. As you saw,
I'm going to go back for a minute.
Is the libido the reddening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here, coming back here, these are different processes, different operations, alchemical operations. Prasanatio, sublimatio, silvatio, solution, putrefaction. Distillation, I'm sorry, I'm reading in Latin, I'm used to reading in Latin. coagulatio and the tincture. And what's not in here is the conuncio, which I'll talk about. So we're going to talk about four different operations. So let's just take a 10-15 minute break, go to the bathroom, look at a few books, and come right back. Because in a group of this size, it takes a while to get back. Turn down the lights. I want to put on a piece of music, and I actually want you to stand up. And I want to put on a piece of music, and I just want you to. I gave you the words, but I don't want you to read them right now.
Sorry, that's all. The lightning. We had the thunder.
The light is this lumina tori. So everybody just put stuff down and stand up. The two songs that I gave you, which are from Bruce Coburn. Anybody know Bruce Coburn? He's wonderful. And I feel like they have wonderful alchemical images in them. So I want you to close your eyes, and I just want you to allow yourself to flow with the music and let yourself, I know it's kind of cramped quarters, but just allow yourself to move with the music, okay? And I find it. Go back. Okay. Oh no, now we have a technical problem. Hold on. He doesn't know what the program is. There we go. Okay. Try this again. There we go.
Particle of your life.
For just a second, the hills of morning. Underneath the mask of the sulfur sky, the sulfur, which is the mercurial metal that doesn't burn, a bunch of us were busy waiting, watching the people looking ill at ease, the people who need the Negredo, watching the fraying rope get closer to breaking. Women and men move back and forth in between effect and cause. Beautiful line. And just beyond the range of normal sight, this glittering joker was dancing in the dragon's tail. Who do you think the glittering joker is?
Very mysterious.
Mysterious. Yes. Let me be a little of your breath moving over the face of the deep. I want to be a particle of your light, a lumina tura, a tiny particle of your light flowing over the hills of morning, the albedo. The only sign you gave of who you were when you first came walking down the road was the way the dust motes danced on your feet, danced around your feet in a cloud of gold, the chemical gold. But everything you see is not the way it seems. Tears can sing and joy shed tears. You can take the wisdom of this world and give it to the ones who think it all ends here. Let me be a little of your breath moving over the face of the deep. I want to be a particle of your light flowing over the hills of morning. Any thoughts about that? Okay. So, we're going to talk about four different alchemical processes. Solutio, coagulatio, calcinatio, and penuncio in a little over an hour. And there were some questions during the break. Did anybody want to bring something up?
We hit on Cerrado, the red, at the end, is that what you call it? What was the red?
Rubido?
Rubido, sorry.
Rubido, Rubido. Yeah.
And so, is that it? We're done with that topic, or is this linking?
Oh, it'll come back. Okay. They all come back around, right? Let me talk a little bit about Rubido. Thank you. It's the new life. It's like the divine child that gets birthed. It's the birth. It's the realization. It's the insight. It's the thing that happens when suddenly we've been working and working and working and working on something, and suddenly we get the new perspective, and we go, oh, that, I get it. I understand it. Now I'm not going to get caught in it in the same way. So it's that coming together of understanding. So, it's the higher consciousness that comes from nature, something that nature alone cannot create. So we create it with nature. We're the co-creators. Humans recognize themselves as part of nature, so we recognize that we're not just separate. We have to work with our own nature, with outer nature, inner nature. We have to balance with it. It's the living Tao. So it's that time of awakening, or that coagulation of understanding. Does that help? Okay. Yeah.
I had spoken with you about saying some more about how the guiding spirit.
About the guiding spirit. Yeah. So the guiding spirit, Mercurius, is the guiding spirit in alchemy. He's the symbol of that. And but from our dreams, from our unconscious, we get our guiding spirit. We are all guided. If we choose to listen, we can choose to not listen. That's free will. But if we listen closely, and we when I'm working with somebody like Anita Green, it has to be an embodied process. Jung says that over and over again. He wrote 4 books on alchemy with Von Franz's help, just a quarter of his collected works. And Ion, which is his most mystical work, also has a lot of alchemical weavings in it. So our guide is our body, our guide is our embodiment of the process, our guide comes from our dreams, like we might have a figure or something that is helping us. So each one of us has our own particular relationship to that guide, which in general alchemy would call Mercurius. Okay, so whatever that is for us, but it is there. And that's what's so hard to remember when we're in the middle of the negredo, when we're in the middle of the darkest night, is that it is a guided process. And that's what, as I said, that's what we hold as a friend. We might hold that, okay, I know you're in this dark place, but I know that you can come out of this. I know that you can learn from it. That's what I hold as an analyst, the knowledge of where the person is, sort of. And I don't, as an analyst, I'm not guiding the person. I am walking beside them sometimes. I feel like a lot of times I'm walking behind going, where are we going? Sometimes I'm leading in front saying, I think we're going this way, but I never think I know for sure. That would be fixing, making it into a fixed reality, which it never is. So I'm facilitating the person listening to their own guiding principle and listening, being able to stand themselves. Being able to withstand their own process. And I'm trying to facilitate that and sort of create a safe container for it. Does that help? Okay. So, Seleucio is the water. It's one I seem to work a lot with. I don't know water in my chart. So I get it all over the place. I spill things. I throw water all over the place. I had a horrible accident in 2013 on a bridge where I could have gone into a frozen pond, and thank God my car danced across the bridge. So water is a real important process for me. And this this is a foretelling of the rubedo, of the end of that place. And the rubedo, we don't just go through this process once, remember. We go through it over and over and over and over again. Sometimes they're big marriages, sometimes they're big insights, and sometimes they're just little ones. So this is a young prince. So water is when we do Seleucio, we're trying to we're either drowning in water, like the old king up here, the old attitude that needs to go away, needs to get dissolved, needs to go back into the unconscious, or is done with, and so we're dissolving ourselves in some feeling, some projection. We have to enter into the process. Jung over and over and over again says, you aren't going to change or transform unless it's embodied. You can talk about it, you can read about it, you can think about it all you want, but until it happens. And that's why the symbol is so powerful, because when you have a living symbol that really speaks to you, it leads you, it fascinates you, it takes you into the experience. Okay? So everybody has different symbols. Yes?
You keep talking about the process. Are there steps to the process, or this is the steps?
Well, these are, and the solutio might not come first. I'm just talking about it first. It is a part of the process.
The process, though, is the process of transformation.
Thank you. Yes. The process of transformation, the process of change that we're always in. The world is impermanent, as the Buddhists say. And it's very hard for the modern psyche to get that. We want that clarity. Okay, so solusio is about the liquid. It's about returning to the undifferentiated state of the feeling. Emotion does this a lot. Of an energy, if you're having a, if you're meditating and you're suddenly in a very spacious, altered, subtle body state, you might be in a state of solusio. It might be terrifying. It might be wonderful and blissful and fascinating. It's the, it's, we're returning to the womb, to the water, the waters of the womb, to Mother Nature, in order to immerse ourselves in whatever we're, whatever the symbol is, whatever the emotion is, whatever the energy is, to, and it, we're dissolving fixed ideas, beliefs, fixed feelings that, you know, I hate this person, oh, I love this, oh, I adore this thing. Well, that can be just as stuck as hating, right? So we're dissolving, we're laying, we're, or we're being dissolved. We're not necessarily trying to do it. So it's the descent into the unconscious again, it's the womb of rebirth. There are all these ways or different ways of going into the unconscious. And we question our ego attitudes here. So Eros can be an agent of solusio. When we fall in love, it's wonderful, isn't it? For a while. And we, I feel like when we fall in love, we open up to our potential and our possibility. Right? Suddenly, the other person feels like, we feel new. We feel like we've never been able to talk to a person like this before. We've never been so understood. We've never been all these wonderful things. And we open up and we dissolve. And then we come back to reality and our we realize, oh, that was a projection. Darn it. I just met the right person. So so Eros is an agent of solusio. Let's see. And it's about cleansing, of course. It's about purifying. It's about cleanliness, washing. The dew of the soul. The dew of the soul. The recovery of feeling after feeling barren. After an intellectual abstraction, we solve by the transfer into the realm of feeling. We soften. When somebody's in my office and they're tense and their body, they're terrified, what I'm trying to do is help them to learn that they, if they soften and they release into their body and their emotion gently, very gently, they can come through whatever they need to come through. So inflation is also an agent of solusio. We get, when we connect with the divine, when we have a blissful opening experience, we dissolve, but we also get inflated. Oh, wow, look at the spiritual experience. I'm so spiritual. Look at the spiritual experience I have. It's better than yours. I'm closer than you are. So inflation can be it's a swollen ego, dissolve, and it gets dissolved by its own excess. Von Franz says a wonderful thing. She says, and Jung says this too, you can't go through this process without becoming inflated, and then you become deflated. The ego comes back to its little normal reality and goes, oh, here I am again. But that was so nice. It's so wonderful. Analysis or interpretation of dreams is a way that we go into solusio. We go into the dream. We allow the dream to come up and speak to us. And we separate out the different themes and images of the dream that tells us what we're doing. An immature ego wants to surrender to solusio, maybe all the time, right? But that's not healthy either. So any of these operations can be too much or perfect for the process. So sometimes Seleucio can create great anxiety if we have a very immature ego. Somebody has a very insecure and immature. Addictions, they're a dissolution. They're a Seleucio, right? But not in the right way. We're using alcohol. We're using drugs to dissolve our personality, whatever we're trying to dissolve. But that's not healthy. We have to take the projection off the spirit in the bottle and bring it back. An encounter with the numinous, the self, as I said, is that. Okay. So what we want is we want to have this healthy relationship between the ego and the divine, the ego and the outer world. The ego, a healthy ego is flexible. It can mediate. It goes, okay, now it's time for the divine, now it's time for, I have to go to work. I can't be in a state of Seleucio at work. I have to put on my mask. I have to perform these things. Jung once gave a lecture, and somebody in the audience knew that he was horrendously upset about something. And he gave his lecture, and the person came up to him afterwards and said, "How can you do that? Isn't that fake? You just put your mask on, and you gave this wonderful lecture, and I know you're really upset." And he said, "Well, but that's not why people are here, to listen to my upsetness." So we need to be able to put back on the ego and the mask at times. If you can contemplate your feeling of inner stagnation and barren wilderness and impregnate it with the interest born at alarm at your own inner death, then something can take shape in you. If you prove receptive to this call of the wild, the longing of fulfillment will quicken the sterile wilderness of your soul as rain quickens the dry earth. So let's look at this. So here's the old king dissolving, and the sun and the moon shining down through the rain in the back, and I think there's a city back there somewhere. And this is the young prince, or princess, as the case may be. But look at the robe. It's too big for him, her. They haven't grown into it. And these are the seven luminatori, the seven metals, and this is Mercurius. And here we have a double crown. I think, let's see, what's the double crown? I think it's lead at the bottom. Yeah. Oh, okay. Iron is the first level. Then we have silver, or the feminine. And then we have the gold. The iron is the prima materia, Mars, blood, passion. The silver is the moon, the feminine, the gold is the sun. So there's a real connection, an interconnection between these two. And the sun, it's hard to see, but it's a very serene human face. Then it throws rays behind the youth. And then this is the morning star, sorry. But also it shines on the youth in particular. So the morning star, the albedo, the beginning of the coming into consciousness is shining on him. And he's on dry land, so he's safe. And this seems to be a track that goes into the water. And the water meanders around, but here's the deep water. And these trees have new green, so they're growing. Maybe the spring, so they're growing. And he's holding the golden apple, which is sacred to Aphrodite, sacred to the goddess of love. Somewhere there's a five-pointed star. These might be five-pointed stars.
The morning star.
Is that 5 points?
Yeah.
No, I think it's more than 5 points. I think these are five-pointed stars, I think. Yeah. And the apple and the ball play toys are part of the divine child. So the divine child is that new life. It is the true, our true nature. when somebody has trauma, to me the divine child is connected to the innocence of the child that before the trauma that we want to connect with and help bring out. And let's see. And the rocky outcropping, remember this shape? This is like the first one I showed you of the place where we're digging. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of in the back now. That's part of the picture, but it's got all this green growing on it. Okay. And this is the dove, of course. And the dove has to do with peace, but it's interesting, in alchemy, the dove, and in the red book, that Jung had a serpent and a dove, and in the serpent, Jung entered into the underworld, and the serpent guided him in some ways. He never ascended. The red book is not about ascending, it's about descending. And the white dove comes to him and brings messages from the ascendant realm, but he doesn't actually enter into that. So I think that's another reason why alchemy was so important to him, because it was really about the earth and the embodiment and the descent. So I'm looking for the bird. We'll see the bird later. Anyway, the bird goes up and down, but often the bird in alchemy descends and alights. It brings the celestial down to the human level. And as somebody said, this is the road, the reddening, and these are the protection of the feminine. You know, we have nature, of course. And the birds, as you said, the birds are specific birds in the picture.
The plants are too.
The plants are, right, they are. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. We don't have time for all that detail, unfortunately. But it goes on and on and on.
It seems like it might be worth a comment on the nature of digging.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, if you hold the space for the process, then digging might be too active. I don't know. It's just a funny word.
Hmm. Well, I think anything can be too active at times. Right? Solutio can be. I mean, we can dive in instead of dig. We can dive in the deep end instead of walking in from the.
So I think titrating is a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is if we can. It's
right,
it's the best
exactly.
idea.
Right.
But sometimes we're thrown in the deep end, and we're just So I'm going to read a couple of dreams that have to do with Seleucio. This is a woman. So the dream is she's caught in a monstrous sea. She's a very strong swimmer. She's almost exhausted. She can't hold out any longer. Suddenly, a square houseboat like Noah's Ark that she was familiar with as a child appears. She gets to the Noah's Ark, and she is hauled up, half fainting, by Dr. Jung. I love dreams in books. They're the perfect dreams. I mean, this person probably had hundreds of dreams, and yet this dream is just perfect. So this is she's in Seleucio, she's drowning, she can't handle it anymore, and her guide, Dr. Jung, comes along with Noah's Ark and all the animals. Isn't that a beautiful image? Okay. Then another dreamer. He's at the center of a great city consciousness, watching a vast stream of humanity pass by, every type and description. It's like a great river. I am fascinated. So the river of humanity, of his own, her own humanity, that they're fascinated by, which is what we need to be. I lived in Texas for 25 years, and I learned all about Christianity and evangelical and fundamentalism, and now I'm in Buddha and Judaism land, and it's all very interesting. But I think one of the things that we have to keep is our humanity, because that's where the eros is, that's where the connectedness is. If we get too much in the spiritual, if we do too much spiritual bypass, it's pretty useless. Okay, here's another one. This woman is in a party in her mother's apartment. Okay. Her mother was a very difficult part of her psyche. She had a big mother complex. And there's a very strange and disturbing man there. I have to look this up because I can't read it. It's too dissolved. Okay. There's a party at her mother's apartment. There's a strange and disturbing man, Mr. X, a poet. He's the guest of honor. The mother leaves the party. When she does, there's a kind of universal spontaneous rejoicing, which she feels, though I don't know what's up. Almost at once, Mr. X gathers all the women around him in a semicircle and undresses and ejaculates a huge stream of sperm which falls like a fountain on each of us. I thought the idea was for us to serve him in this way, but as it turns out, that's only part of it, because as the sperm shower hits us, we experience our own separate and individual orgasms. Now, if that's not a powerful dream, I don't know what is. No wonder I couldn't remember it. So here we have the mother complex, which is breaking up, dissolving, with the masculine sperm, the shower of sperm, and the sperm is the spermaticus. It's the creative force that impregnates. So, but each woman, it's not about serving the man, the masculine. It's about the woman receiving and having her own connection to the feminine and her own sexuality. Okay. Let's see, what do we have? Okay. So solutio can happen at any time. We can go into solutio, we can go into any of these processes at any time. Here's another picture of solutio. This is actually sort of the coniunctio and the solutio. The king and queen come together with the wings, and they come into the pool. It's a beautiful image of the solutio. We have to dissolve into the eros inside of ourselves. Here, this is called the alchemist in the bath. And this is a particular image, as we see, he's being heated up. The alchemist is being heated up. Here's the alembic. This is the heated water, smoke coming out of the furnace. And the alchemist always needed a helper. For the man, it was a sora mystica. And for the woman, it was the masculine. And here is the bird again. And this bird has descended and alighted on the alchemist's head. So the bird is a part of his spiritual connection. But he's not going up. He's being dissolved in the alchemical vessel. So he chooses to suffer both personal transformation and spiritual. That's what he's doing. He's suffering personal. He's being heated up in the water. So here we have sort of an image of the calcinatio, the fire process of burning or heating up, and the solutio. And this is the courtyard of a palace. And again, we have nature, very specific. And the color of the bellows is the gold, the alchemical gold, the reddish gold. And here we have the black, the white, and the reddish gold there, and the gold. And blue is also another important color. And this, actually, this here we have something, this gas is called sublimatio. So we have sort of three different pieces, processes going on here. The solutio, the calcinatio, and sublimatio has to do with vaporizing. Whatever we're dealing with goes into some other realm, and we don't have time to talk about that one much, but there are a number of different processes, and this would be our culture tends to sublimate everything, right? So we don't want to get caught in sublimatio. Okay, so let's see what else do we have here. Okay. So this has descended, so this dove has descended and is on the head. And the symbolism of this is that we can't transcend the limits of the material reality. So that's coming down. And we need a humble and embodied spiritual attitude. That's what the bird is trying to tell us. So the chthonic, we, as we work on our chthonic earthly level, chthonic means the underworld, the bird gets released also, so it can come up and down. But here it's descended. And where is it? Where is this? Here we have Vulcan, which was the god of the forge, who's working. He's the blacksmith. The blacksmith also, as the metallurgists were, the forerunners of alchemy. So we have the blacksmith. He's a great shaman of the gods. Any other thoughts as we look at that?
Did you already describe the person standing at the very, very tippy top, on the top of the book there?
Up there?
Is that a person?
Let's see. I think that that's the wrong one. This stuff gets so detailed. Well, these are the humans. She has a little vessel right there that are observing and conversing about this, which sort of means bringing it into consciousness. I forget who that is exactly up there, but it's definitely somebody important. Yeah, they're all these figures are part of the symbolism of the whole thing. And as you see, this goes way back. It just keeps going on and on and on and on into the background. So we could get into more.
Mm-hmm. It's something just people about how the culture sublimates everything,
mm-hmm.
and then don't get caught up into what?
Abstracting.
And then is that a
thinking.
Form of sublimating?
Yeah, thinking. Analyzing.
Is that how the culture does it?
I think our modern culture tends to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what it's, can you say sublimation means put it to its side, don't really go into it?
At times we might want to do that, correct?
Right.
We might want to sort of put something on the shelf or sort of, or we might want to make it get up above something in order to look it down,
right.
and be clearer about it. So sometimes that is a good process. All these have their times that are important to be in or not. Yes?
I don't want to take up too much time with that. We've talked more about blue, we've covered red, gold, green, black, white, but I haven't heard a whole lot about blue, but it seems to
be
such an important event in every single picture. There is a blue holding the ball, there's a blue cape right now, there are blue pants and then a blue sky, and it varies. Even the alchemist was in a deep blue bath.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into blue because it's
so deep.
Well, it's just a whole other, you know. So, yeah. Okay. So here we have, this is called the regeneration of the Ethiopian. So this, again, we have a number of different processes going on. He's coming out of a mud bath, mud all over. He has a white hand, okay. He has sort of a helmet on, and it's reddening, is happening here. So he's emerging from this negredo, the mud, the shit, the poison, the underworld, whatever, the depression, the overwhelming emotion, whatever it is. And he has the albedos, that's his left hand, so it's in the hand of the side of the unconscious still. And he sort of can't see yet. He can breathe and he can smell, but he can't really see yet. So here's the reddening. And behind, of course, we have the sea again, the unconscious, and this is the unconscious. And let's see. And the white hand is the one that's reaching out for help, which is the left hand. Often, sort of unconsciously, we reach out to the guides to what a help. We reach out and say, help, please do something. Because when we're up against particularly archetypal forces, we cannot shift an archetypal force. If we've been, say, the Holocaust or torture or something, we need to come through something like that. We need the positive archetype to help us, because it's beyond the human level. Or when we're in a tremendous state of pain, sometimes we need, and we're facing something that we've never been able to face, we sometimes need the positive archetype to help us. Okay. So this would be sort of like Dante's Inferno. He's coming up. He's coming up from the Inferno, the muddy swamp. So who is helping him here? We have this. These are peacock feathers. So we have the peacock coming back. See the little dots for the peacock feathers? And she has the blue. This is all flowers. So she's nature. She's handing him the robe of the end of the process. She has it. So the archetype has it. The angel has it. The feminine has it. And she has the gold, phosphorus gold, and the crown. So the wings, the peacock is the dawn of the new day. And so she's the transcendent. And this is the six-pointed star. Alchemy is also related. In India, it manifested as tantric yoga. So here we have the spirit going up, the triangles going up and down, which is also the Jewish star of wisdom. And the union of Shiva and Shakti. Shiva and Shakti. And it's also the Star of David, the Solomon Seal. And in Christianity, it's the Upper Trinity and the Lower Trinity, which is a very interesting idea. Okay. Let's see. And I think back here we see this little, once again, the city of consciousness with the road leading to it that maybe comes down from there. Okay. Any other thoughts as we look? And here we are. What's it? The deer is always a symbol of a deer move back and forth between the unconscious. They're like a vehicle between the unconscious. And here this would be and the monkeys are closer to us developmentally or instinctually. And the beautiful parrot, the many colors of the parrot, the gold, the blue, all the different colors of alchemy. The green gold is also here too, the green gold.
I have a question.
Sure.
We're interpreting these images with the perspective of Jungian analysis mm-hmm. and ideas like consciousness and unconsciousness.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that they were made, they didn't have that paradigm. So what did they mean then?
This is what they mean. I mean, the Jungian analysts who have studied this, the people who have studied this for...
But I mean, did they have different words for them, or were they just...
If you read alchemical texts, they're very strange.
Uh-huh.
And Jung and von Franz and other people have studied these alchemical texts, and the gift that Jung gave to us is he has an amazing gift, and von Franz and other people like him have an amazing gift to read this archetypal language and to find the symbolic... the symbolic work in it and to translate it. So that's what we're looking at, the translation of not only his pictures, but Trismolson's actual paintings, which are the symbols, are the symbolic visual aspects. So, yeah. Does that help? So
I'm just curious, what was Trismolson? He was depicting something that was...
He was depicting his inner process.
His inner process.
And
okay.
the art.
Mm-hmm.
The art of alchemy.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is what it is about. It is about this inner process of working with the unconscious. So the alchemist was working with a particular metal or a particular solutio. He was taking sulfur and dissolving it into... whatever he was dissolving it into and making the gas go off and doing all these alchemical... concrete processes, but what he was doing was he was projecting his own, because he thought that it's good to come around to this again, because the alchemist experienced that life was alive, that matter was alive, and it had certain magical qualities. So he was projecting his own inner psychological and spiritual work onto these processes that he was actually doing.
But without being aware of it.
Right.
In the way that we are.
Well, he would be aware, he was aware in terms of, these were very spiritual people. So this was their meditation. So awareness, that he would become aware of things through this process of projection and go, oh, this is what it means. So it's about finding meaning. Yeah. Does that help? That makes it clear. Good.
It's just curious.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's the main point, I think. Yeah.
So, the vessel appears in a number of the things, quite a few of the things, and sometimes it doesn't. And I'm just wondering if it just implied, because it's framed in a particular moment in a particular world.
Right.
Is there,
well, I think the frame is also a container, isn't it? In nature herself. Yeah. Yes, Judy?
So when this person now, this is working, they would maybe take an emotion, or like, I hate my brother, or I had a dream of a dark mud pile, and would take that and project and say, I'm working with this hate of my brother on this black material, and then as it transformed and burned, they would get another image of, so the projection would go back and forth.
Right. So yes. So through the projection onto the materials that we're doing all these various processes of burning up and dissolving, and so the alchemist wasn't consciously going and working on hate with my brother.
Right.
But they would go, there's something in meaning here. What is it? So it was later that people began to realize that what they were doing was projecting the hate or the spiritual disconnect that they were feeling, or a mood that they were seeing in the process of the fire, the anger of Calcinatio, the pain or the tears of Seleucio, you know, that these, and the energies of Seleucio, that these were happening in front of them, but they were experiencing them at the same time. Okay. So here we, this is important, this is the next piece, this is coagulatio then. So we're coming out of the mud, out of the Seleucio, out of the dark, and we're, the mud is drying, it's coming together. The earth is becoming heavier, becoming more firm with the spiritual aspect standing on it. Creation myths are aspects of coagulatio. In all creation myths, you have some way of this huge chaos coming into some focus, coming into some creation, coming into a world view. A creation of the world. So other images might be, in Hindu mythology and other mythologies, there's a churn. I forget which god churns in Krishna, right? No, it's not Krishna. Anyway, in Indian mythology, there's a god that churns the milk, the sacred milk. It churns and churns and churns and churns, and it creates, begins to create the world, begins to solidify into butter, as we would say, or into the world. So creation myths are wonderful myths of coagulatio. So in a dream, if we, as you were saying, if we look and we work with the dream and the image, the feeling, the emotion, the understanding, the insight begins to become firm, where it's becoming coagulated. Okay. Let's see. So the self is a prior, the self, the big self, is a prior existence out of which the ego evolved. So that's a coagulatio. We're a coagulatio in the first place. The reincarnation or the incarnation of Christ is a coagulatio of the spiritual dimension. God so loved his son that he gave his only, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son to incarnate, which is one of the main pieces of the Christian myth. So this is coagulatio is often promoted by action, diving, churning, whirling. There are a lot of creation myths that the being, the animal, whatever, goes down to the bottom of the sea and brings up the first piece of earth, and then it grows. So it's a solidification of the personality. After we maybe come through solutio or calcinatio, we need to solidify ourselves again. We need to live it out after we've been through a tremendous period of pain or loss or whatever. It takes time for that to dry out, for us to be able to look back and go, oh, now I get it, 3 years later. Okay. It promotes ego development. It promotes our sense of good self. Whoops. What happened? Oh, never mind. Oh, the projector went down. Oh, we did. This happened before, didn't it?
It's been so long.
That's a year ago.
Mercury is in the house.
Thank you very much. Okay. So any specific form of manifestation structure that solidifies life's energy into a concrete expression. So anytime we paint or draw or make music or dance, we're coagulating maybe a feeling or a expression of something. When we share our fantasies or our dreams, there's a certain coagulation that happens when we just share it. I'm thinking of Teresa of Avila, who had all these powerful spiritual experiences, and her priest said, you have to put them in a form, you have to write them down. And she wrote The Inner Castle, which was a symbolic expression of those experiences. So it's a way of assimilating a complex. It's a fall of innocence, coagulatio. It's like, clunk, here I am. Oh, darn, I can't believe that anymore. You know, I can't, yeah.
I'm intrigued by the symbolism of the primates in that picture as different stages of what you're talking about. The one in the background is behaving perfectly naturally. It's scratching. The other one is giving a lecture to one of the deer.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if that represents the development of thinking process or the assumption of the ego.
Could be, yeah.
I'm also a little bit concerned. I mean, I don't know what the current status of evolutionary discussion was at the time, but I'm a little bit concerned about the appearance of the Ethiopian and the appearance of the ape.
Right.
At an intermediate stage.
Yeah. Well, I think that was the language that was not, wouldn't totally be inappropriate. And he's obviously, I mean, it doesn't have to do with him being black, it has to do with the mud. But yes, the term, it's like Jung used the term primitive, so that was, primitive was what was used there, which we would never use now. Right? So, yeah, I think this is an evolutionary sort of process going on here. Go ahead.
I like the elk actually is the first thing that I've seen crossing the border of the frame and reaching the outside right down there on the right. His face.
Yes.
And everything is reaching out.
Yeah. He's right there. Intermingled a little bit. Okay.
I don't know how. I'm really struck by how the yellow and the red that together they make orange, which is the color of renunciation. In the Hindu, you know, that's why you have Hindu monks and nuns wearing orange, renunciating the self, and
renunciating the ego, personality.
Yeah, so it's almost like this is teased that out into stages.
So it's the red gold that we talked about with Sophia's wings in the beginning, and the red gold is that philosophical gold, right? It's the awakening. It's the awakened state that we're all working towards in various levels, not just spiritually, but also consciously.
Consciously, yeah, bringing it in.
Yeah. So, okay. And also, coagulatio happens in relationship a lot. You know, the relationship, my understanding of myself gets it's coagulated by my relationship with somebody else, or the transference that we have in relationship. And Eros would be a part of that. Okay. Let's go to the next one. Oop, we have 25 minutes. Okay. Jung says, to the extent that I managed to translate emotions into images, that is to say, to find the images which were concealed in the emotions, I was inwardly calmed and reassured. And he also says, God wants to be born in the flame of man's consciousness, leaping ever higher and higher. And what if this has no roots in the earth? If it is not a house of stone where the fire of God can well up, but a wretched straw hut that flares up and vanishes, could God then be born? One must be able to suffer God. That is the supreme task for the carrier of ideas. He must be the advocate of the earth. God will take care of him herself. My inner principle is God needs man in order to become conscious, just as he needs limitations in time and space. Let us therefore be his, her limitation in time and space, an earthly tabernacle. Okay. So what do we have next? So this is an image of Coagulatio. Here we have the alchemist with his book, his learning, and he has his own gold chains around his neck. And here we have a toad, lowly toad, and an eagle. And behind you have the city and the sea. Let's see. Mr. Toad. And so this is talking about spirit needs to be connected or chained to the earth, to the simplest of animals, to the simplest instincts, and the instincts need a connection up to the heavens, or the spirit. The spirit and the soul, the spirit and the body, the mind and the body, and in the distant, the road goes to the city of consciousness. Okay. Oh, here's a good image of Calcinatio. So let's talk about Calcinatio. Here's the alchemist. So Calcinatio has to do with the fire, has to do with burning something, purifying it through fire. The intense heating of a solid to drive off the water, the emotion, the excess. So fire can be libido, instinct, sexuality, passion, creativity, anger, desire, intense affect. And here we have all the demons, all the different pieces of the psyche that get burned off, that get processed through the maybe we need to be really angry. Maybe we need to go in a rage. Maybe we need to feel passion again when we don't feel passion. And back here, all the alchemist different elements, and how this is a hub, and this is the fire here. That he's being put in the furnace.
Why are those demons when they're musical instruments, horses, women, houses?
Well, it's not just demons. It's parts of the psyche. Some of them
are
demons. Yeah, things we're attached to, things that we're dealing with, things that we're hanging on to, attitudes, shadow, all kinds of things. Whatever is coming up from the unconscious. Blood, we can also be baptized in blood. The fire, intense affect. So you see, affect comes up a lot. It can come up in Seleucia. There's certain kinds of affect that are related to Seleucia. There are certain kinds of affect that are related to Coagulatio, to Calcinatio, to all the different things. So it's a drying out process of a lot waterlogged complexes. So somebody who's too emotional, who's too angry, who's too whatever the intense emotion, it's a process of sort of coming to terms and coming into that understanding of the emotions on a more concrete level, perhaps on a more personal level. It's not so intense anymore. We need to share and make conscious. liberated access becomes the fire that dries up and purifies the unconscious contaminants. So the affect might relax. We might go, oh, okay, I don't need to feel this so intensely. It's the intensity. Kundalini is the fire of the divine. So it's archetypal energies that transcend the ego, that purges the ego. The kundalini fire purges the ego. So let me give you a couple of dreams about this. So this is a dream. So a woman is bending over a cauldron, holding a ball of fire in her hands. With nonchalance, no pain or harm, she holds and shapes and squeezes the ball of fire as though it's laundry. The dreamer watches with amazement. And as the dreamer woke up, she realizes that the dream is related to her about to embark on a huge new creative process, a creative project, that she can do it. She has help. She has help of a guiding spirit that can handle the intense fire and the creativity and the passion of this new project. So another one. There's a star enters a room. The star becomes a grandmother. The grandmother offers her shaman's drum and drumsticks from the child's drum with red kinetic, the drum has red kinetic cloth streamers. And it's like fire. The streamers are like fire. The grandmother says to the dreamer, "Do not be afraid. The fire is your fire." And the dreamer feels reassured of startling and emotional and inner experiences, like she can handle them. They're the drum. She can drum them. She can work with them, with the drum. Another one. I'm sitting at a dinner table with guests. Something spills and catches fire. The table is covered with little flames shifting all around. It's a beautiful sight. Awakening, I think, of the Pentecost. And this is from a young research scientist who is brilliant and formulated a particular discovery, and the professor belittled him. And he wanted to reply with great intensity to the professor. And so he was surprised. He did. He got up the courage, the fire, the Pentecost, the fire. He got up the fire and he confronted the professor. And the professor said, I made a mistake. So that's an image of the fire in him. Okay. Next. Okay. So we're getting to the end here. She's not supposed to have red on her breast. One of our scanners broke, so we had to use another one, and somehow, but maybe she is supposed to have red on her breast. I don't know. It happened. Mercurius is here, for somebody said. Vinegrato, the libido. Yes. So here would be sort of an alchemical vessel, wouldn't it? The grave, in a way. The dissolution of the king and the queen that come totally together in the conjunctio, in the sacred marriage. And the conjunctio is the culmination of the opus, the culmination of the process. Now, again, we can have many culminations of many processes, okay, so it doesn't end. We have little culminations and we have big experiences of the sacred marriage. So this, again, happens not in the full moon, but in the darkest night. It happens in the darkest night. And the lesser conjunctio is a union of substances that are not thoroughly separated or discerned. They're basically emotional from the personal unconscious, from our childhood, whereas a bigger conjunctio would be a connection with the spiritual realm. The unconscious... Emger says, the unconscious takes the same attitude towards the ego as the ego takes towards it. I'm going to say that. The unconscious takes the same attitude towards the ego as the ego takes towards it. So paying attention to imagery with the objective psyche generates reciprocal results. The ego must be open. Jung says, flesh glorified itself in its own way. It would not transform itself into spirit, but on the contrary, fixes the spirit into stone, fixes the spirit into our body, fixes the spirit into the earth. Conjunctio leads to the death, or the extinction of our present consciousness. And And until this present consciousness has been extracted, then we don't have the transformation. So here is the soul that goes up to ascends in this particular. This is from the Rosarium, which is, what's the Rosarium? In volume 16 of Jung. And this is where he talks about the transference and the countertransference. This is his seminal paper on the transference and the countertransference and the relationship between the therapist, the analyst, and the client. And that there is a merging that happens. If you aren't in the vessel with the client, then you can't help them. So this is the birth of the divine child, or inner experience of the connection to the big S sun. So the soul ascends to the divine essence, out of the negredo to purify. So this is another operation. This is the conjunctio operation. So here we see the dissolution into the water in the tomb, and the soul going up. And this is where, when the soul ascends, this is where, in this level of conjunctio, this is where we become aware of the collective unconscious, the spiritual realm of the unconscious. And the ascent of the soul can be very powerful. It also can be kind of dangerous, because it's a Jung called it an abaissement du niveau mental. It's when the consciousness sinks into the unconscious and kind of gets lost in a way, in a solutio in a way. And it's a very sensitive time for this to happen, because we're sort of, our soul is a bit disconnected, a bit out there, processing itself. So we don't know what's happening. Oops, wait a minute. Oh, yeah. Okay, hold on. Yeah, this is right.
This is just one person, though, with two heads.
Right. Before, remember the one we saw before of the king and queen? They were still two people.
The one just before?
No, the colored one, remember a while ago? So before this picture, this is a series of pictures. So before this picture, you have to sort of flow with that. You can't try to look at it linearly So before, several pictures before, there's a whole series of pictures of how the king and queen come together with the left hand, and how they reunite and all this stuff, and then how they're together in the bath, and here now they're joined. The masculine and feminine in us is totally integrated, is not separated, it's undifferentiated, which is a way we have to allow the masculine differentiatedness in us and the feminine relational part of us to merge and to become together in this level, right? Does that make sense? Yeah. But no, none of it makes sense. So. Okay. So here is the this is called the return of the soul. And I'm sorry, let me get this straight. The return of the soul. So after the soul has been sort of processing itself in the unconscious, then and we don't know what's going on. We just feel lost and like something deep is going on, but we don't know what it is. Then the soul comes back to rejoin, and the masculine part is looking up towards the soul coming down. So there's that differentiation happening, and the two birds are Mercurius. Here's Mercurius. The ravens, the chthonic, mnematic conflict. The conflict, this reminds us that the conflict is not over. This is just a process here. That the bird can come up from the ground again. They're here. Mercurius is here. So this is a connection between the body and the heart. The heart is the same. That's a good image of the heart being the same. The effect of the unconscious can produce positive or destructive effects. Let's see. The soul is reunited in one, the one born out of the two, the one born out of the masculine and feminine aspects of ourselves. And that's where the soul can reunite. And again, this is about withdrawal projections. Jung says that the soul is henceforth a most seraphic angel. She can make herself whatsoever she will and do and have whatsoever she will. For all qualities have but one will in agreement and harmony. And this is the same, this same one will is God's eternal, ineffable will. And from henceforth, the divine person is in our own nature, and we have become one with God. And then this picture. So here we have the purification of the dew, which is again part of the process. So the king and the queen, the masculine and the feminine, the psychic parts are still joined totally. And the dew is the portent of divine birth, the divine birth. That, so we're moving into the albedo and the libido. And this is the water of human understanding, the removal of superfluities. This is a time when we might need more intellect, we might need to step back and have more intellectual understanding. It's the imagination activity of intuition, the anticipation of possibilities whose fulfillment can never be the object of empirical experience. The illumination through the realization of meaning. So this is about meaning, once again, which is what the whole thing is about. So let me read a couple of dreams of Pinocchio. We're getting tired, and I'm getting tired, and my voice is going. At the end of the Red Book, Jung has this wonderful little odd talk about love. At the very end of the Red Book, after he goes through meeting with the devil and all the different sides of himself and the shadow and this and that and this and that, he talks about love. He says, but love is the inescapable mother of life. Life should never be forced into love, but love into life. Also, as long as love goes pregnant with life, it should be respected. So the conjunctio is about the final erotic eros principle of connection. So a woman dreams that she is in an underground cavern. There are rooms full of stills and alchemical apparatuses, and there are two scientists working over a final process of prolonged series of experiments. The end is to be golden crystals separated from the mother liquid resulting from many previous operations. And while the chemists are working in the dream, she and her lover lay in an adjoining room, and their sexual conjunctio, their sexual embrace, supplies the energy that is essential for the crystallization. So that's an image of the crystallization, becoming, making of the gold. So the gold, what is the gold? Let's come around. What are we talking about? What is the philosopher's stone? What is the gold? What is the true gold? So the true gold is ourselves. The true gold is our true nature. Our true nature to our own personal self, our true nature to the spiritual self, our true understanding and coming through issues with our loved ones, people we hate, people we love, people we project onto. So the true gold is, let's come back around to that. The self.
The pure essence.
What? The pure essence?
Pure essence.
The wholeness.
The ideal
connection.
Self.
What?
The ideal self.
The ideal self. I don't think it's ideal because then we're sort of idealizing. Right? Maybe. And then you might have another idea of ideal self. What's your idea of ideal self?
Well, it's the aspiration of going through the full cycle.
Okay.
Being whole or balanced.
Okay, so going through the whole cycle and being whole or balanced. Okay, balanced. Yeah. Okay, balanced, whole. Yeah. So what else? What? Okay. Just speak up. It's okay if you're wrong.
Truth.
Authentic.
What?
Authentic.
Absolutely.
Love.
Meaning. We get it. Suddenly, this conundrum we've been in, or this confusion, suddenly we go, oh, that's the meaning of this. you know, I get the meaning. We're drawn by, let's see, a particular symbol. What's a symbol that really fascinates somebody?
Spiral.
A spiral. Okay. So a spiral, we're fascinated with a spiral. We just keep pondering. We think about it, we dream about it, we play with it, we don't understand what it means, but it moves us. It brings us, it's trying to bring us into an experience of something. It's trying to speak to us. All of our dreams are just stories from the unconscious that are trying to speak to us, that are trying to tell us where we are and what we need to do and how we need to process something. So a spiral, it might be a particular symbol that you're drawn to. So we ponder it, we meditate on it. And and the meaning doesn't come from thinking about it, but suddenly one day we go, I have this feeling about it. I understand what the spiral means in my psyche. You know, but you feel it, you don't just think about it. Any other thoughts, any other symbols that are very strong? Yeah.
The sacred hoop.
The sacred hoop? What?
It's the sacred hoop with the
cross in it? Okay, yeah. Sacred hoop with the cross in it? Yeah. Yeah. So it takes us into a process, the symbol, whatever it is. All these are just symbols that take us into the process and bring us here. Where is here? Where are we trying to get? What? This is Alex Gray, his work. Does anybody know Alex Gray's work?
Yes.
Yeah. So what are we doing here? What is all this stuff?
Lightning,
energy, centered right in those, looks like it's sort of right in the solar plexus, right there.
It's a presence.
Presence.
What is.
Right, presence with what is. That's what, as Jung said, we need to become comfortable with ourselves, like not with everybody else.
The proper seat.
The proper seat, okay?
Oh, look, everybody's having sex.
There you go, lots of kunyumpio happening, huh? Various forms of tantric kunyumpio. And tantric, of course, tantric isn't about having sex, is it? It's about raising the energy, it's about working with the energy. And here we go into the gold. Maybe this is the alchemical gold. And these look like more archetypal. This is Kali here with her, all of her necklace of skulls. So there are different gods and goddesses around the edge, the archetypal aspect around the edge, which he's connecting with, this figure is connecting to. Okay? One more picture. This is one of my favorites. This is Dante and Virgil coming out of hell, the inferno, coming out of hell, and this is the kunyumpio. This is the divine, this is the big kunyumpio. This isn't just a little insight into my personal problem. This is the huge kunyumpio with angels and angels and angels and the wholeness, the circular, the truly awakened to the true self, to the true understanding of life. Any thoughts or questions? Yeah.
It's the realization and experience of oneness.
Yes, absolutely. This is Dore, D-O-R-E. This is the painting by Dore. So let's just talk a little bit.
It's interesting. Dore means golden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful.
Is it anything to do with individuation?
Absolutely. Sorry, I never mentioned that. My goodness. This is individuation. This is why Jung found that alchemy, all these symbols, all these processes in alchemy, truly spoke to his experience and what he was trying to convey. And he spent years writing 4 books on it, or more. Yeah, good, right. Individuation doesn't mean becoming perfect. It means becoming who we truly are and being able to carry the burden of our faults and the burden of the divine. Right? Yes?
It seems like many of the images in alchemy leading up to the final ones of the
about wholeness.
Wholeness, yeah.
There's often an image of a king or a person in the foreground and then a person in the background, and there are two different things happening to them. Mm-hmm. They're one that you should have the king going down into the sea, the old king going down into the sea and drowning, and the new, newly formed prince emerging in the front of the picture. I think it's encouraging just to remember that in the process, one constellates the other. And it's important to remember that, because when you're the experiencing the Nagado and the going down into the darkness, it can be a very desperate moment when you don't see that other part that is constellated.
Right.
And to remember that, sometimes you're reminded in the process quite naturally, because I think you're held in it mysteriously.
With the dreams, the images, experiences,
synchronicities
remind us that we're in this process with the different aspects, different archetypal versus personal. Go ahead.
Okay. But yeah, it's encouraging to remember that, I think.
It's hard.
For any
it's
of
very
us.
Hard.
We all go through these processes.
Right.
But to remember that in that stage of having to let go of some old way of being, something new is constellated for you.
In the dark.
In the moment. It's not that you're just, you may feel separate, but it's not truly separate. You really are constellated both.
Right.
The union will, is imminent.
Right, and that's sort of sometimes what somebody else carries for us.
Yes.
The hope. To carry the hope that we will get through this process. We will come in through the dark. We will find the luminatori, the little moments of light, the little insights, the little connections, the big connections, the star, the sun. Right.
We also need help. It's important.
We need
that.
Help.
When Dante's about to enter the underworld, he's met by a helper.
Right, the guide.
Who comes to help him. And if he, it was a personage that he trusted.
And this is what Jung, yes, we do need the guide. And this is why Jung discovered, which wasn't new, active imagination, where we consciously work with the unconscious. We meditate on it. We allow it to come up. We let it come through us. We let the material come into our... We express it through art. We express it through movement. We meditate on it, whatever. And the dreams bring us the guides. The synchronicities remind us that there's hope. There's something
and
happening.
This connection between inside and outside, which is... All of this is about the union of the opposites.
Mm-hmm, yes.
We experience in reality, for whatever mysterious reason we don't know, this is the way we are.
Yeah, it seems to be the way the human species does it. They need to separate into duality so that we can look at it and that we can come back together in a new consciousness, in a new way.
It has to do with consciousness.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a client years ago who said, if I can just step 1 inch away from my complex, away from my solution, away from my being burned in the fire of rage, whatever. If I can just step 1 inch away, then I can work with it. I can dialogue with it. I can play with it. I can, and remember with the children, it's also important to try to be curious and to be playful if we can. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just loving this thing about, you know, that you said at the beginning, you need a vessel.
Right.
And that needs to be separate. You know, that there's something about the pressure from saying, okay, I'm going to let go of everything I know, you know, and go into that dark night. And, you know, we have to do that. There has to be a shift where that happens. And then like you say, the different kind of light comes on from the inside. But
yes,
there's something about... we can spend such a long or lifetimes not doing that. It's just so scary that place.
It is.
To make that shift. It just seems like that's a key thing.
Yeah, we sort of have to be willing to keep staying with whatever wants to come up, don't we?
Right.
And keep asking for help, really.
Right.
Because many meditation teachers that I know say you can't do it alone.
Right. And so... Like you're saying, when you get in the dark, that's when you ask for the help. That's when you really need the help. That's when you start asking. You start developing a relationship. Is that moment when you go, okay, I'm making the move, is that in one of these alchemical processes?
It's in all of them.
It's in all of them.
So we've sort of been swimming in this material. I'm sort of saturated. How about you? But yeah, each one of these things that I'm talking about are a piece or a container for, or like the negredo, the albedo, the rubedo, they're sort of like the big strokes of the process, where the castanadio, the putrefactio, the mortificatio, solutio, all those are particular ways that we work with the material. Okay. Work with it on an emotional level or on a psychic level or imaginal level. Okay, so they're sort of trying to give us something to hang on to in a way, in themselves, sort of an image, or this has been talked about for centuries, for millennia, of course, and this is the form it takes in this particular way. Any other thoughts or questions? Yeah.
I'm feeling very connected to, you know, my fellow humans,
mm-hmm.
through time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that helps, doesn't it? To feel connected to the millennia of people who have gone before.
Yes.
Where no man has gone before.
Mm-hmm.
Women.
Mm-hmm. And to know that so much has changed on the surface, and so little has changed
mm-hmm.
in the depths.
Mm-hmm.
If anything has changed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love the way Jung talks about the collective unconscious is the objective psyche. It knows. Okay, that's where the spiritual, the archetype lives. It knows. It knows where we're going. It knows what we need to do. It pushes us.
It's like an elder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this woman who gave, the grandmother who gave the drum, that would be a beautiful image of a guide that was giving the dreamer, okay, you can do this. It's just a drum. And I'm with you.
We come with the programming.
Mm-hmm. We do. We come with the programming to do this. And we have to have the courage just to be with it. And that's hard. That's really hard. Okay, one more.
Well, this is really getting out there and musing, but we saw a program recently on CERN and
uh-huh.
search for the Higgs boson. And I suddenly was thinking, this is a huge vessel. This is an alchemical process.
Yes, we are an alchemical process, an alchemical vessel.
Hugely inspiring.
Yeah, Jung said, as I said in different ways, nature doesn't just create this, we don't just create it. It's a conjunctio between us and nature. It's a dialogue, it's a working together that we realize we're part of nature, and nature is part of us. And that's one reason I love the lumina tauri, these tiny sparks in the darkest night. The darkest, darkest night, which could be a lot of pain, or it could just be, I don't know. The little light is there in the darkest night. Okay, let's stop for now. So please join me at the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street, and we can just have a cup of soup or dinner and talk if you want to. So thank you for coming, and please take some of these.